From WHYY in Philadelphia, I'm Terry Gross with Fresh Air. Several rock musicians died recently of drug overdoses. The music industry is taking stock of itself and asking if record executives and music publicists need to rethink how they handle the situation when a musician is addicted. On today's Fresh Air, we'll talk with Tim Collins, one of the leaders of this new effort. Since 1984, he's managed the band Aerosmith. He's credited with helping the band's members kick their habits and revive their careers. Collins is himself a former coke addict. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews two new books about punk rock. One is an oral history of the music. The other is a novel by performer Richard Hell, most famous for the song Blank Generation. That's all coming up on Fresh Air. First, the news.
From National Public Radio News in Washington, I'm Korva Coleman. President Clinton says the television industry now supports a three-hour minimum of educational programming for children. Mr. Clinton is now calling on federal regulators to join in. He's urging the Federal Communications Commission to adopt a rule requiring television broadcasters to provide at least three educational programming hours per week. Advocates for children's TV say the deal is historic and that producers must now work at developing quality television for children. Mr. Clinton is asking Congress for more power to fight terrorism, NPR's Mara Liasson reports.
President Clinton will sit down later today for talks with congressional leaders and top federal law enforcement officials to discuss how to expand the federal government's tools against terrorism. Yesterday in New Orleans, the president said he was encouraged by a statement from House Speaker Newt Gingrich that Gingrich was backing away from his earlier opposition to expanded wiretaps and a requirement that explosives be marked with chemical taggants. The president has pushed for those measures in the past, but Congress has rejected them. The White House hopes that the meeting today will come up with agreement on a package of additional measures against terrorism. The anti-terrorism bill that the president signed earlier this year provided $1 billion in extra money for law enforcement, but a provision to allow the FBI to wiretap suspected terrorists was stopped by opposition from civil libertarians, and a measure requiring taggants was stopped by the National Rifle Association. At the White House, I'm Mara Liasson.
The Central African nation of Burundi remains calm following last week's coup, despite fears that the military takeover would spark ethnic fighting. Burundi's new leader is opposing foreign plans to send peacekeepers to the country. NPR's Michael Scholar reports.
Burundi's new leader, Major Pierre Buyoya, ruled Burundi as a dictator for 6 years. His best credential is that he held a fair election in 1993, lost it, and gave up power. His worst credential is that during his rule, the Tutsi-led army continued to kill and abuse the Hutu majority. Yesterday, Major Buyoya promised to tighten control of the military and stop killings of civilians, though the army will still fight Hutu rebel militias. He said he will also protect Rwandan refugees, all Hutus who just last week were being expelled by the army, but will not accept foreign peacekeeping troops on his soil, all of which makes African and Western leaders uncertain how to act toward him. They have condemned his coup, but think he might help end Burundi's 3 years of violence. This is Michael Scholar in Nairobi.
The FBI says it is making progress on solving the Olympic bombing case. A spokesman says the agency has several good leads on who might have detonated a pipe bomb in Atlanta's Centennial Olympic Park. Authorities don't have a suspect yet, but they do have sketches of possible suspects based on eyewitness accounts. On Wall Street, the Dow is down about 7 points at 5,466. The Nasdaq is down half a point at 1,078. This is NPR. The UN Security Council's Sanction Committee is to discuss Iraq's limited oil-for-food deal arrangement. Linda Fasulo reports from New York.
On May 20th, Iraq agreed to a UN-monitored sale of $2 billion worth of oil over 6 months to buy needed food and medicine. 10 days ago, Secretary General Boutros Boutros-Ghali approved Baghdad's food distribution plan. But now, diplomats say, the Security Council's Sanctions Committee could approve the procedures governing how the oil sales and food purchases would be made. Once that is done, UN monitors would then have to be stationed in Iraq to oversee the process. Baghdad has accused the U.S. of delaying the start of the deal, but Washington has wanted to ensure that Iraq be prevented from exploiting any possible loopholes. For National Public Radio, this is Linda Fasulo in New York.
Nuclear negotiators are in Geneva working on a nuclear test ban treaty. China's lead negotiator says his country wants to see some changes to the plan. It's not clear just what China wants to alter. China detonated a nuclear device underground today. Beijing says this news should be welcomed since it's China's last nuclear test. The Chinese negotiator at the treaty talks says his country would like to see a new test ban treaty signed before September. China and India have been reluctant to sign the document. Republican presidential candidate Bob Dole says he is a true friend to the West and that President Clinton is not. The likely GOP presidential nominee is attacking the president over his stance on the Endangered Species Act. The Republican says Mr. Clinton has sided with environmental extremists who don't care about the West's economic prosperity. Dole is on a 4-day campaign swing through the West that began yesterday. He stopped off in Billings, Montana for a rally where he called for the immediate ouster of Interior Secretary Bruce Babbitt. I'm Corva Coleman, NPR News, in Washington.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross. The rock music industry has been shaken up by the widespread use of heroin and by a recent series of drug-related deaths. Jonathan Melvoin, who toured with Smashing Pumpkins, Shannon Hoon of Blind Melon, Kristen Pfaff of Hole. Jerry Garcia's death and Kurt Cobain's suicide were also linked to drugs. Now there's a movement within the industry to try to help addicted musicians kick their habits. My guest Tim Collins has been described in Rolling Stone as the music industry's most impassioned anti-drug crusader, renowned within the industry for having engineered Aerosmith's resurrection after Steve Tyler and Joe Perry's collapse into heroin addiction. The band had split apart in the early 80s. Collins reunited Aerosmith in 1984 and has managed the band ever since. I asked Collins the extent of drug use within Aerosmith back in 1984.
Well, it was interesting, Terry. It was a different era then. Pretty much everybody that we were doing business with and everybody that we were associated with was doing some kind of drug, you know, whether it was cocaine, marijuana. And I wasn't even aware that they were still, you know, using heroin. So I don't know how much they were using. It was never something that that was, you know, open and public. It was something that really, what I saw it as, it was something that really pulled them apart as a band. And what my role as a manager is very similar to being a coach of a team. It's about pulling the band together. And I saw it as something that fed isolation and you know, pulled them apart and just, you know, destroyed the whole team vibe.
When did you become aware of how much drugs the members of the band were using? And when did you start to think that this is a real problem?
It's fascinating. What happened was that I fell into drug usage myself. I became a cocaine addict. And it wasn't until I hit my bottom. I mean, my denial system was very strong. And it was just a way of life. And so when I hit my bottom, which was not a pretty bottom, and I got clean, after I got clean, I opened my eyes were opened, and I looked around and I said, oh, my God, what am I involved in? And that's really when it hit me. But again, denial is a really, really strong force. And seeing something like that is not easy to deal with. So it didn't really hit me until I watched the lead singer of my band, Steven Tyler, collapse on stage in Springfield, Illinois. And I heard medical people say, I think he's dead. And that's when it really hit me what was going on and how serious this was.
Well, did it hit Steve Tyler, who was pronounced dead? Did it hit him, too, when he came to?
No, it didn't. Not at that point. It took a bit longer. It took about another year before that really came home.
Well, after you got clean and you looked around you and realized how drugs were affecting the band, what were some of the ways you realized that drugs were affecting their performances on stage and their behavior off stage?
Well, one of the things that was happening was that, you know, in the early days, the use of drugs, you know, heroin and cocaine, and heroin in particular, enhanced their creativity. And eventually what happened was that it totally robbed them of their creativity. So they had released an album that, you know, they were used to selling millions of records, between 2 and 3 million records every cycle, and they released an album that sold about 300,000 copies. It was a dismal failure. And that's when it really hit home, because when I took an honest look at the record, I realized that the music just wasn't there. And it really hit me, you know, how could we have released this product? And as I said earlier, denial is just a really strong force.
What about how everybody behaved in hotels and on tour?
When it really hit me the hardest was I remember going into a hotel in Pennsylvania and one of the band's bodyguards having to carry Steven Tyler through the lobby. I mean, he literally couldn't even walk. And it was, everybody in the hotel stopped and looked. And until they started looking, it wasn't anything out of the ordinary for us.
Right.
And, that was pretty bizarre. And it really hit me like, wow, this is definitely another planet. Something's going on here.
Now, one of the things that you're saying now is that a lot of music industry executives and publicists almost function like enablers when they make excuses for bands who are addicted, and bands who can't make their tour, the publicist might make an excuse like, well, it's a stomach disease, upset stomach or something. When Steve Tyler collapsed on stage and he was considered dead for a couple of minutes, how did you deal with it as the manager? What did you tell the public? What did you tell the press?
Well, it was interesting. We become masters of the spin, and I fell prey to it. That's why I can say, and I can point the finger, because I starred in the movie. We released a statement saying that he had the flu and had been exhausted and had been on the road so long, and we pushed him to perform, and we covered for him. And we thought we were doing our job. And it wasn't until I got off the road and I was able to really look at it and say, this is crazy. I'm helping to kill this guy. And I found somebody who had been through the war, who turned me onto an interventionist. And we started a process of recovery.
I want to get back to the intervention in a moment. But first I want to hear why you felt that the only approach that made sense was the denial approach, the he had the flu approach. Had you considered for a second being honest, or is that really unthinkable?
I had absolutely considered being honest, and it was unthinkable from the people around the band, the people who had an investment in them, the people who, make the records, and the people who feed off the band. And the pressure is great. The pressure is great to keep that image up.
Now, do you think you would have been doing a service or a disservice to Steve Tyler to publicly say that he had a heroin addict? Heroin's illegal, so if you say somebody's using, they might get arrested and do time in addition to the public embarrassment.
Yeah, it wasn't even a thought to mention heroin. That didn't even come into my mind because, first of all, it wasn't my heroin use, and I was working for him. I'm his manager, and I was working for him. He was paying me, but I realized that it had gone too far. There was a line that had been crossed, and once I got sober, which I was at that point, I realized I was no longer willing to cross that line any longer, and I had to look at either changing careers, or standing up to him. And it's a really difficult place to be in.
If you're just joining us, my guest is Tim Collins, and since 1984, he's managed the band Aerosmith. And now he's working to mobilize the music industry to help musicians get off and stay off drugs. As the manager of Aerosmith, you said that for a while you were helping the people in the band get drugs. What did you do to help them score?
I never actually, copped drugs myself or anything like that, but there were people who were on our payroll, promotion people, different people, runners, different, security people who I knew they were doing that, and I just looked the other way. And so, it was a conspiracy of silence. It just wasn't, the thought of a member of the band copping drugs, possibly getting arrested, was out of the question. So I had, a team of security people that had their areas secure, and we knew that, there was no way that anybody could get in there that could cause any trouble for them. And these people who are on a payroll who helped to arrange things for them. And I just looked the other way.
Since you had a problem yourself with cocaine, you knew how hard it was to give up drugs and that it's hard for somebody to just, talk you out of doing it some more. So what was your strategy once you were determined to try to get the band off drugs?
Well, I have a background of I played in a band as a musician, but my real love was business. So I I took basically a business approach to it, and I looked for a model. I looked for a successful model to copy, and I looked around, and I couldn't find one. And an angel came to me, so to speak. A good friend of mine who's an attorney, had been my attorney for many years, introduced me to a fellow who had been a talent agent in the 70s and had been really at the top of his game. He had represented a lot of major superstars and had hit such a bottom with cocaine and heroin that he literally was a homeless person on the streets of New York for a short period. And he was now sober and in recovery and had really made a comeback and was a vice president at a major talent agency in New York. So he set up a dinner for me with this person. And I had this fascinating dinner during which I had all the reasons why what he did wouldn't work for my band. And as we were able to get past all those obstacles one by one, I left that dinner with the name and the number of an interventionist in New York City, and in a spirit that although I knew I wasn't capable of getting them sober, I knew that I now had some tools that might make it possible for them to decide to get sober. That one of the problems with addiction is that when you're in it, it's like being in a fog and you can't hear. You hear what you want to hear, and you certainly don't want to hear about getting help. And that the tool that he had given me with this interventionist was kind of like a moment when the window could open where they could hear. And then I knew then that it would be their choice, and if they didn't choose to get recovery, then I could leave at least feeling good in my heart that I had done the best I could do.
What was the first intervention like?
It was the scariest thing I've ever been involved in my life. It was fascinating. We assembled the band and a couple of key people around the band, and we intervened on Steven Tyler, the lead singer, who was the identified patient in the worst, the most progressed, I don't want to say worst, the most progressed in his addiction, and also the most vocal and the most out front about it, the most flamboyant. And we all gathered around a table, around a conference table in my office, and we made lists. We worked for several days. We made lists of giving him examples of when he did something in his disease and how we felt about it. You know, an example would be, when you came to the office last Thursday and asked me for money for your vacation and later used that money to cop heroin, you know, I felt really sad. Or when you insulted this person, or when you almost crashed this car, or when you crashed this car, different really examples of him really active in his disease and how destructive it was to himself and to others. And so we put these lists together, and we supported each other in really, searching our own selves to really, come up with the ones that were really difficult for us to even say. And we put these lists together, and then we put a plan together to get Stephen to the room at a time when we knew he wasn't using, which was really difficult because he was at the stage of addiction where he was pretty much using all the time. And so we managed to, with the help of the people who managed his money, the business managers, we were able to cut off his funds for a few days. So we knew that he would turn to a methadone clinic to get something to keep him from jonesing. And we called him up, and I called him up, and I basically told him a lie. I told him that I wanted him to come to the studio, to the office, and do an interview with the BBC, which was 6 hours ahead, and I needed him there at 6 a.m. At the time, he had a big hit with Run DMC, the rap group, and it was a worldwide hit. And Aerosmith had never really, at that point, been big overseas, so he was very excited about the possibility. And I told him he'd need to be there at 6 a.m. because we knew that the methadone clinic, wasn't open that early. So he came in, and we were all sitting around the table with this interventionist. And he just turned white, and he wanted to run out the door. But we asked him to just sit and listen and told him that at the end of it, he could do what he wanted to do.
And what did he want to do at the end of it?
Well, it was pretty fascinating. This interventionist we used, Dr. Lou Cox from New York City, was pretty tenacious. He was very loving and soft, but he was tenacious in a way that I don't think I've ever quite seen. And it was like a game of it was like a mental martial arts almost, where he was ready to go, and then he said, but I need to make one phone call, and he made a phone call to his wife, who was also using, and he came back into the room and said, no, I'm not going to go. And he was, this is after 3 hours of, you know, of the intervention going on, and he was like he was at the beginning. And so we had to again go back and work his defenses down. And Lou Cox just kept doing it. And it took about 9.5 hours till finally he agreed to go into treatment.
Were the other members of the band in on the intervention?
Yeah, they were all in on the intervention, and none of them were clean at the time.
They must have felt pretty hypocritical, and it might have been easy for Steve Tyler to think, well, you know, who are you to be preaching to me?
Well, that all came out in the intervention, and it was amazing. It was really amazing that it worked, because a lot of things were hidden going in.
So did that make any of the other members of the band who were still using think maybe they should stop too?
Yeah, what came out of it was one went into treatment immediately, and eventually the other three all got clean within a short period.
Tim Collins is my guest, and he's managed the band Aerosmith since 1984. And now Collins is working to mobilize the music industry to help musicians get off and stay off drugs. Tim, let's take a short break, and then we'll talk some more. This is Fresh Air. Back with Tim Collins, manager of the band Aerosmith, a band that was once deep into drugs and then got clean sometime in the mid to late 80s, I guess. And now Tim Collins is working to mobilize the music industry to help musicians get off and stay off drugs. Tim, did all the members of Aerosmith get sober at about the same time?
Within about 6-7 months of each other.
Now, was the band performing during this period when people in the band were trying to get clean and going to rehab?
No, it's interesting, Terry. One of the things that I had to do, which was really difficult for me as the manager, was that once we got into the process of recovery, one of the therapists, they had invited us down for a family session, and they treated Stephen as if the band was his family, because the band had become his family of heart. And so I was sitting in the session, and you got to remember, I was in early recovery myself, and they asked me, you know, what I was going to do when he relapsed, and I said I'd bring him back, and they said, the therapist just looked at me and said, we're not going to take him. He's been already in 4 or 5 places, and he's a chronic relapser, and you're enabling him, and if you continue to enable him, you know, he's going to die. And she reached in her drawer and took out what I found later was a starter's gun, but took out a gun and put it on her desk and said, why don't you just shoot him now because you're helping to kill him? And I got really angry, but it drove the point home. You know, it drove the point home that I really was part of the problem.
But you thought of yourself as part of the solution at this point.
Oh, absolutely. But I knew that it would be real, that the organization really had to look at itself and had to seriously change. And they came up further with further advice. And again, it's always, you know, hey, we're going to give you the advice. You're going to do what you're going to do. And they told me that he needed at least a year away from the business. So the thought of basically closing the band down for a year in an industry where things happen, you know, on a moment's notice and everything's happening so quick and so fast and you got to be in the flow was incredibly terrifying to me as the manager, the leader, you know. And I just didn't know what kind of effect it would have. And when I weighed it, you know, it was like the way they put it to me was, you know, you're either going to do this or you're going to quite likely be going to his funeral in a year. And so we did it. We basically stayed off the road for a year and a half. And although they worked on music, they didn't do any public appearances. They didn't do any interviews. They didn't make any videos. They didn't do anything at all except, you know, take care of themselves and follow a program of recovery, and play music at home, you know, and in the studio.
Did you explain the strategy to the record company?
Yeah, what I did next, it was interesting. We were recording for Geffen Records, and once we got our plan all together, I flew out to Los Angeles and sat down with David Geffen and his executives and told them what I planned on doing. And they were very supportive. They were very supportive. They were a little cynical, but on the surface, they were supportive. I don't think that they really believed it was going to work. And I got a lot of calls from people in the music industry at the time saying that I was taking the soul out of them, and that once you took the drugs away from a musician, that they couldn't write. And they gave me a lot of examples when that had happened. But the interesting thing was that the people who had the drugs had been taken away, they didn't have a support system, and they didn't have a path of recovery. They didn't have a program around them. They didn't have people and a container to help them, you know, stay on that path. And I knew that I didn't have a choice, because these people, as I said earlier, had become friends, and I didn't want to be part, you know, be going to their funerals. So I figured, well, you know, if they can't write any longer, you know, at least they'll be alive. And what I found out was that Aerosmith went on to write some of their greatest music and have their greatest commercial success after getting into recovery.
What was different in the studio and on the road?
It was amazing. It wasn't easier, but it was a lot more alive. It was a lot more of a band. It was more difficult to handle as a manager. You know, I would often make jokes in the early days that I'd like to be able to give them a Valium or two to calm them down, because they were a lot more emotional and they were feeling a lot more.
What do you mean by emotional?
They just, you know, when you're using drugs, you dull those feelings. You take off the edges, and they were a lot more alive, and a lot of really great music came out of them. And it took longer. And you know, when you're running a business, that's, you've got deadlines and commitments, and you know, I'd already taken so much time, but it was okay in the end. In the long run, the band went on their next album after getting into the recovery process, sold 4 million records, and they went on to sell 4, and then the next one 6 million, and then the following one after that 14.5 million. So they went on to a real winning curve from the record company's point of view.
Tim Collins has managed Aerosmith since 1984. He'll be back in the second half of our show. I'm Terry Gross, and this is Fresh Air. Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Major funding for Fresh Air is provided by Borders, where the love of books and music sets the standard. Additional support comes from the listeners of WHYY in Philadelphia, where Fresh Air is produced. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
Coming up, we continue our talk with Tim Collins about how the music industry deals with addicted musicians. Also, rock critic Ken Tucker reviews 2 new books on punk rock.
There was a time when I was so brokenhearted. Love wasn't much of a friend of mine. The tables have turned. That kind of love was the killing kind. So listen. I'm crying when I met you. Now I'm trying to forget you.
This is Fresh Air. I'm Terry Gross, back with Tim Collins. He's helping lead a campaign within the rock music industry to get record executives and publicists to re-examine how they deal with addicted musicians. Collins has managed the band Aerosmith since 1984. He helped them kick heroin, and he kicked a cocaine habit himself. Now, you said back when the band was using that you knew you were an enabler because you knew that there were people in security and on the larger team who would help them get drugs and help protect them while they were using them. Now that they were clean and you were clean, what did you do to keep them clean when they were on the road? There are so many temptations on the road and you're uprooted from the stability of home.
Well, what we did is we hooked into a network of other people who were recovering, and we took people on the road with us to support that. And we found a really fascinating person in Los Angeles who had been helping musicians and a lot of other people, but had been pretty adept at helping a lot of musicians, a gentleman by the name of Bob Timmons, who's a drug and alcohol counselor in Los Angeles. And he flew out on the road every couple of weeks to work with the band and to support them on their journey, and create a safe place where they could just talk about, you know, basically it's a grieving process of letting go of that lifestyle.
What about things like alcohol? You don't need a dealer to get alcohol. You just go into a bar at night, or you open up the mini bar in your hotel room at night.
Well, it's interesting. We removed all alcohol from backstage at all the concerts, and we removed all the alcohol from all of the hotel suites. So that was on our rider before we went into the hotel. They received a fax from our office, and all of the mini bars were drained. And we encountered a really fascinating thing about 6 months out on the road. We had a chance to take a band on tour with us called Guns N' Roses, who were Aerosmith 10 years earlier. They were notorious about their drug and alcohol use. And we almost didn't take them because we felt that it would have been too much of a temptation for the band. And I realized that in itself would be enabling, that business had to go on, and that Aerosmith had no right to dictate to anybody else about drug usage, and neither did I. And so what we did is we sat down with their agents, and we devised a plan where there'd be a certain area where they were, where they could do whatever they wanted to do, but they wouldn't cross the line and go over into the Aerosmith area backstage. And it worked out just fine. And what it did actually was it enhanced the recovery process, because the band, you know, saw these people every night, and they would be, you know, double twisted and completely messed up on different substances, and they would just go, wow, we can't believe we lived like that for so many years.
Now, how did you get clean? You were the first in the group.
Yeah, it was fascinating. I was on tour with them in Florida, and I woke up one morning with my nose hemorrhaging from too much cocaine, and I just really hit this bottom, like how did I ever get to this point? It was like this moment of truth. And I picked up the phone and I called my my doctor, who was also a good friend, and I told him what was going on, and he said, why don't you get on a plane and come on home? And I said, I can't, I have three more shows. And he said, well, you know, the last time I saw the band, I didn't see you on stage. I think they can do them without you. And I came home and sat down, had a chat with him, and told him honestly about all of my intake. And he, you know, turned me on to somebody who really helped get me into a program of recovery. And eventually I went to a treatment center that helped straighten me out.
And what did the band say to you about giving up drugs? Did they, were they supportive or were they cynical about that?
I actually kept it secret. You got to understand, I was managing a band that was a drug culture. You know, it'd be like walking into the Grateful Dead's office in the 60s and saying, I don't do drugs. And being the manager and the leader and dealing, you know, on their behalf, you become part of the culture. And so I kept it secret and never shared it with them. I didn't know if I was going to stick with it. So I just kept it secret and just kept off them one day at a time.
Do you think keeping it secret made staying straight any harder or easier for you?
A lot harder.
Because you couldn't ask for support from anybody.
Exactly.
Couldn't commiserate.
Almost an impossibility. It's a miracle that I was able to do it. I had some good friends who are outside the system who I talked to every day and who I spent a lot of time with. who helped me. But it was, I look back and I don't know how I did it.
My guest is Tim Collins. He's managed the band Aerosmith since 1984. We'll talk more after a break. This is Fresh Air. My guest is Tim Collins. He's managed Aerosmith since 1984 and helped the band members kick their drug habits. Now he's helping lead a campaign to get the music industry to re-examine how it deals with addicted musicians. Well, let me get to the present. You're one of the people sounding the alarm in the music industry, saying that a lot of people within the music industry basically function as enablers for musicians who are addicted to drugs. There was a meeting of NARAS, the National Association of Recording Arts and Sciences, just a few months ago. I guess it was in December. And about 400 people from the music industry attended. You were there. You spoke. What did you say at the meeting?
Well, you know, I told my story, basically. And I also I pointed out that when I hit my bottom and then I realized I had to help Aerosmith, I looked around. And I asked my record company for help, and they didn't know who to send me to. They didn't even think it was a problem. And so I realized that, you know, the industry, that not only was I in denial, but the industry was in denial. And I knew that, you know, it was like there was no one to turn to for me. And so it was really difficult to find a path out of this dark cloud. And so I wanted to share my story with other, and I have for many years with a lot of other managers and musicians and record company people. But what happened and how that meeting all came about was that 6 months or 7 months earlier, I was sitting at a dinner table with Bob Timmons, a drug and alcohol counselor from Los Angeles, and Shannon Hoon, the lead singer of Blind Melon. And we were having a really wonderful discussion. Shannon had just started, had just stopped using drugs, and was trying to straighten his life out. We just had a wonderful dinner, and I had shared my story with him, and it was just a wonderful night. And I left there feeling, well, what a magical guy. And it was just a few short months later that I read about his obituary, and it just so touched me. I called up Bob and I said, you know, I spend so much time, telling my story to so many people in the music business. I said, but it's not being heard. It's not getting out there. And he said, you're right. And he introduced me to Michael Green at NARAS. And we all shared, personal connection with addiction and recovery and in some way, either in family members or in ourselves. And we said, we got to do something. And we called that meeting. And just called it with the intention of just, not to, it's funny, we've been accused of being the sober cops and all that kind of stuff, but it's not what it's about. It's about just creating a system of education and also a place, they have a toll-free line where if you want help, you can get it. You know, we're not saying that anybody should stop doing anything, but if you've got a problem, that you should be able to reach out and somebody should be there.
What kind of help do you think that the music industry can provide to individual musicians who are addicted?
Well, the only thing you can really do is you can educate them to help prevent it. And then for those who've already crossed the line, you can, have a system like what NARAS has done with this toll-free line where people can call up anonymously and talk to somebody who's been through what they're going through. I mean, musicians live in a very different world, especially successful ones. But even ones starting out who aren't successful, they live in a very different world. And in Los Angeles, there's a lot of musicians meetings, and places
recovery
where they can
meetings.
Go. Yeah, just support group type places, and where they can just talk to each other and say, oh, why, you know, I had trouble writing, or I had trouble on the road, and what did you do? Just kind of like what you were asking me, what do we do on the road about the minibar and things like that. So just open dialogue to support each other.
Now, you talk about the importance of education. Don't you think most musicians who start using heroin know that heroin is a dangerous drug, it's very addicting? I mean, most people who are deep enough into music know of rock musicians and jazz musicians who overdosed.
It's absolutely true. It's absolutely true. But what a lot of people don't know about is about the enabling. You know, if Shannon Hoon, his manager, you know, knew a lot of the things that he knows now, I don't think he would have put him on the road. I don't think that would have happened.
Mm-hmm.
You know, maybe he'd be here today, and maybe he'd be creating some great music for us. Maybe not. But it's worth a try, isn't it?
No, with the example of Shannon Hoon, I believe that twice when he was arrested on drug charges, his manager asked the judge to basically send Hoon into rehab, and two different judges obliged and did that, and it didn't help.
Well, what was missing was the element after they came out of rehab. You know, when that therapist said to me, you know, put that gun on the table and said, you might as well just shoot him now. They didn't help to put together a system once he was out on the road. You know, anybody can stay straight in rehab. The hardest core junkie can stay straight in rehab and can really enjoy it. It's when you're out on the road and creating that environment on the road that can support a recovery process. See, the road is very isolating. You're away from your family and your friends and your home and all the normal things. And isolation is it's like what sunshine, you know, is to a garden. Isolation is to an addiction. And it just creates a real incredible environment where that voice comes up that says, you know, hey, you can do it. You're not like the other people. You're invincible, et cetera, et cetera.
After the lead singer of the group Stone Temple Pilots was arrested on drug charges, the band issued a press release canceling its tour, explaining that the lead singer's drug habit had become a drain on the group, and that instead of going on with the tour, the band would wait for him to complete rehab, and then they apologize to fans. What do you think of that approach?
I think they're my heroes. Steve Stewart, who's their manager, is a dear friend, and he's my hero. And I think that's absolutely the best way to handle it.
Did you talk with him about how to do it?
Yeah, I talked with him a lot, and so didn't my friend Bob Timmons. And Steve really reached out, and he's a prime example of somebody who reached out and asked for help and you know, came to a lot of us who have been through it, and then he pieced together what was best for his band, which is what his job is. And, you know, he got a lot of flack for that. He got a lot of pressure for that, but it was amazing what he did.
I think it's fair to say it's a reasonably unprecedented type of press release to send out. What was the reaction within the industry and from fans and from other bands, you know?
Yeah, I think it was shock, mostly. I think fans were sad and disappointed, but I think it was mostly shock within the industry. You know, when going back to the early days with Aerosmith, when after the incident when Steven Tyler collapsed on stage, we had a few more months of touring, and I canceled the rest of that tour, but we never made a public statement because at that time the band was not ready to be public about their addictions or, you know, getting help. They didn't want the world to know. And I felt it that at the time that that was a wise decision because that was the thinking then. And so for Steve to be able to stand up and be public about it sets a wonderful precedent. And I wish we were able to do that 10 years ago.
Jonathan Melvoin of the band Smashing Pumpkins, who OD'd very recently, he comes from a family where, you know, his father was a musician. His father, I believe, was the head of NARES for a while, the National Academy of Recording Arts and Sciences.
That's correct.
I mean, one would assume that he was pretty educated about the musical life and about the impact of drugs, and yet he succumbed. What does that say to you about education and where it does and doesn't help?
Well, you know, again, one of the things that happens in a situation like that was, from what I understand from very reliable sources around that, was that prior to him going out on that tour, that he had never done heroin. And so he was in an environment where it was glorified. And it's a pretty intoxicating thing to go from being a kid in New Hampshire or Milwaukee or were ever to being a rock star in one of the most successful, one of the, at the time, the most happening band in the country, and being out there and playing arenas and stadiums and all of that stuff that goes with it. And it's pretty seductive. But if the people around the organization are educated and the people around the environment are educated, those things, you know, those things can get nipped in the bud. The drummer who had turned him on, from what I understand, you know, had been in rehab and had been on a path of recovery, from what I understand, and obviously had relapsed. And there are clear relapse signs. So if the people supporting them were aware of that, then intervention could be done at an earlier stage.
I wonder how much you think age has to do with the ability to get sober. For example, you and the members of Aerosmith, you were, what, in your late 30s when you gave up drugs?
I actually was 31.
Oh, you were younger than I thought. Okay.
Yeah.
And what about Steve Tyler? How old was he about?
I got to think about that. He was 38.
Uh-huh.
He was 38.
I don't know if you think it might be any easier when you're older and hopefully a little more mature to recognize what the problem is and have more, I don't know, strength in dealing with it.
Yeah, it's definitely a factor. I mean, when you're young and you think that you're invincible and nothing's mm-hmm. gonna kill you, for sure. But, you know, one of the interesting things was that, you know, I once asked Steven Tyler and Joe Perry from Aerosmith, you know, how they start. They were actually trying to turn me on to heroin, and I drew the line there. And I asked them how they started doing it, and they said that Mick and Keith had done it, you know, the Rolling Stones. And, you know, I never got to ask Mick and Keith how they got into it, but probably the old blues guys who they looked up to. And, you know, I've heard it time and time again. I've heard it from a lot of young musicians. You know, it's like, you know, Stephen and Joe did it, Mick and Keith. And it's kind of like something that's passed down. It's that shadow side, that dark side. It's that bad boy, that you know, James Dean, that shadow side that the musician walks into to you know, create and give them that edge and to rebel, and so it's all part and parcel of the package.
Are there other reasons why you think there's so much drug abuse within the rock world?
Yeah, you know, there's the constant pressure, there's the constant dislocation of travel, there's constant pressure to create. And it works in the beginning. You know, you do a little, it makes you, it releases the inhibitions. And if you're a creative person, it enhances your creativity. And there's part of you that you know, believes that that's where the creativity is coming from. And that is the you know, the whole denial of it. Because the creativity is within you. And that's just an agent that helps to open you up. And after a while, it robs you of all your creativity. I mean, I think Joe Perry said it best when he said we were musicians who dabbled in drugs, and we became drug addicts who were dabbling in music.
Mm. Tim, what's the next step for you in your anti-drug work within the music industry?
Well, I've been working closely with Michael Green at NARIS, and just, you know, helping them to set up this program. I'm working with other managers as one of the subcommittees, and we're just setting up a system where, you know, new managers, when they have these problems, can have someone to call on and resources and know where to go to nip it in the bud and find the people who are most effective at it. And also for younger managers to help prevent, to just, you know, an information system where they can learn about the trials and tribulations.
Are a lot of younger musicians and younger managers thinking, like, you know, where do you get off? You had your fun, and now you're trying to police us?
Absolutely. And I'm not trying to police anybody. And anybody who wants to use, you know, that's their business. We're just saying that anybody who wants help, there should be a system where they can get help.
Tim Collins, thank you very much for talking with us.
Thank you.
Tim Collins has managed the band Aerosmith since 1984. Tomorrow, we'll talk more about music and drugs. We'll talk with Nashville-based singer and songwriter Steve Earle. He kicked his heroin and crack habits and is making a comeback. Well, here's Aerosmith's hit, Crazy.
You're packing up your stuff and talking like it's tough and trying to tell me that it's time to go.
Coming up after a short break, an oral history of punk rock. This is Fresh Air. Punk rock has now been around long enough to qualify for its own history book, an oral history, called Please Kill Me, The Uncensored History of Punk, by Legs McNeil and Gillian McCain. It coincides with the publication of a novel by one of punk's first recorded artists, Richard Hell. His book is called Go Now. Rock critic Ken Tucker has a review of both books.
Hate to sound like an old man, but I was there, I lived through it, and I can attest to the uncanny, hilarious, frightening accuracy of Legs McNeil and Gillian McLean's Please Kill Me. It's a history of New York punk rock that manages to contain a whole world. In the early 70s, Legs McNeil was a scrawny malcontent who started up a Xerox fanzine called Punk, which was a bitter reaction to the rock world's then-current superstars, all the Peter Framptons and the REO Speedwagons. Punk magazine championed the Velvet Underground, especially Lou Reed, Patti Smith, and Manhattan cult acts like the Dictators and the New York Dolls. Pretty soon, the punk tag got attached to an up-and-coming generation of younger bands like Talking Heads, the Ramones, Blondie, Television, and Richard Hell and the Voidoids. The punk ethos held that primitive musical technique should never stand in the way of music that was simultaneously impassioned and cool. The core punk philosophy is enunciated in the book by Danny Fields, a writer, publicist, band manager, and scene maker who was sort of a combination of Oscar Wilde and Gertrude Stein in the punk world. Here he describes how the Ramones may have inspired The Clash into being. Mick Jones and Paul Simonon weren't The Clash yet, but they were starting it. They were afraid to play until they saw the Ramones. They told the Ramones, "Now that we've seen you, we're going to be a band." Basically, the Ramones said to them, which they said to countless other bands, "You don't have to get better, just get out there. You're as good as you are. Don't wait till you get better. How are you ever going to know? Just go out there and do it." In Please Kill Me, the authors interviewed scores of people, arranged the quotes chronologically, and let everyone speak for him or herself. Funny and bitter, abounding with the contradictory testimony of a true pop revolution about the only thing everyone agrees on is that Lou Reed is an arrogant creep. Soon after the Ramones' inspiring little chat with the nascent Clash, the Sex Pistols and the entire English version of punk rock exploded throughout the world. There are precise, appalling descriptions of the gleeful violence that was routine at English punk concerts, where, you may recall, spitting at the performer, gobbing it was called, was routine. Robert Quine, a great guitarist for Lou Reed, who at the time was playing with Richard Hell's Voidoids, remembers playing in front of English punks in the mid-70s. It was a horrible experience, he says, being covered with spit every night from the audience and not necessarily out of admiration. Every night I'd go back to my hotel and rinse my clothes out and wipe my guitar off and hope my clothes would be dry the next morning. It was pretty demoralizing being hit in the head with unopened cans of beer. Those cans were like mortar shells, and I was touched by the dedication with which they willingly sacrificed a full beer in order to really harm members of the band. There was one night in Derby. We had just finished a song, and for once I could see the person who was getting ready to throw something at me, so I said, "Don't do it." He bounces a can off my head, and I just unplug my guitar. It's a Fender. They're like baseball bats. I went out in the audience and smashed 7 or 8 of them. I'm a total coward. I'm not a strong guy. I was just flipped. I'd had it, and they loved it. They absolutely loved it. It was a horrible experience. That anecdote from Robert Quine is more vivid than anything in Richard Hell's punk novel, Go Now, which is one of those efforts so patently autobiographical, you wonder why Hell bothers to call his hero Billy Mudd. In the punk manner, of course, Billy is an anti-hero, a struggling musician bleary-eyed from drugs, sex, and hustling to have a hit record. Hell is trying for a hard-boiled tone that too often goes soft, as in this passage. We work our way back to the motel. There in our room we are like damp baby birds with brittle bones drawn back to the nest of our bedside. I take another tiny line of dope and we smoke some grass. I let myself not question the love, and she does the same. Slowly, slowly, and in lubricated fits and starts, we fall asleep. Well, unlubricated, so did I. Thank goodness for the juiciness of Please Kill Me. It gives punk rock a far more unsentimental burial.
Ken Tucker is critic at large for Entertainment Weekly. He reviewed Please Kill Me, The Uncensored History of Punk, and Go Now, a novel by Richard Hell. Fresh Air's interviews and reviews are produced by Amy Salad, Phyllis Myers, and Naomi Person, with Roberta Shurrock, Tracy Tenenbaum, and Joan Tuohy Westman. Research assistance from Rena Bander. Alan Tu directed the show. I'm Terry Gross.
Can take it or leave it each time. Well, I belong to the generation, but I can take it or leave it each time.
Fresh Air is available on cassette. To order, call 1-800-934-6000. That's 1-800-934-6000. The cost is $15.45 and includes shipping and handling. Not all programs are available.
Support for Fresh Air is provided by the George Gund Foundation and the National Endowment for the Arts. Additional support comes from Verve Records, presenting Now is the Hour, a new CD of romantic jazz moods from Charlie Hayden's Quartet West. Their website address is verveinteractive.com. This is NPR, National Public Radio.
On the next Fresh Air, Steve Earle. He's been called country music's favorite lost soul. He's making a comeback after kicking heroin and crack habits. I'm Terry Gross. Join us for the next Fresh Air.